A major part of the answer, touching those aspects of the issue that science can treat at all, must be because Picaia survived the Burgess decimation. This response does not cite a single law of nature. It embodies no statement about predictable evolutionary pathways, no calculation of probabilities based on general rules of anatomy or ecology. The survival of Picaia was a contingency of just history. I do not think that any higher answer can be given, and I cannot imagine that any resolution could be more fascinating. We are the offspring of history and must establish our own paths in this most diverse and interesting of conceivable universes, one indifferent to our suffering, and therefore offering us maximum freedom to thrive or to fail in our own chosen way. A way chosen, one must add, within very strictly defined limits. Here is the cool, authentic voice of a dedicated scientist and humanist. In a dim way, we knew all this already. Chaos theory has familiarized us with the idea of the unscripted butterfly wing flap that, stirring a tiny zephyr, eventuates in a raging typhoon. Saul Bellow's Augie March shrewdly observed the fritillary corollary that, if you hold down one thing, you hold down the adjoining. And Gould's mind-stunning but mind-opening book on the Burgess Shale is entitled Wonderful Life, a double entendre with an echo of the best-loved of all American sentimental movies. At the climax of this engaging but abysmal film, Jimmy Stewart wishes that he'd never been born, but is then shown by an angel what the world would be like if his wish had been granted. A middlebrow audience is thus given a vicarious glimpse of a version of Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. Any attempt to measure something will have the effect of minutely altering that which is being measured. We've only recently established that a cow is closer in family to a whale than to a horse. Other wonders certainly await us. If our presence here in our present form is indeed random and contingent, then at least we can consciously look forward to the further evolution of our poor brains and to stupendous advances in medicine and life extension, derived from work on our elementary stem cells and umbilical cord blood cells. In the steps of Darwin, Peter and Rosemary Grant of Princeton University have gone for the past 30 years to the Galapagos Islands, lived in the arduous conditions of the tiny island of Daphne Major, and actually watched and measured the way that finches evolved and adapted as their surroundings changed. They have shown conclusively that the size and shape of the finches' beaks would adjust themselves to drought and scarcity by adaptation to the size and character of different seeds and beetles. Not only could the 3-million-year-old original flock change in one way, but if the beetle and seed situation changed back, their beaks could follow suit. The Grants took care and they saw it happening and could publish their findings and proofs for all to see. We are in their debt. Their lives were harsh, but who could wish that they had mortified themselves in a holy cave or on top of a sacred pillar instead? In 2005, a team of researchers at the University of Chicago conducted serious work on two genes known as microcephalin and ASPM that, when disabled, are the cause of microcephaly. Babies born with this condition have a shrunken cerebral cortex, quite probably an occasional reminder of the period when the human brain was very much smaller than it is now. The evolution of humans has been generally thought to have completed itself about 50,000 to 60,000 years ago, an instant in evolutionary time. Yet those two genes have apparently been evolving faster in the past 37,000 years, raising the possibility that the human brain is a work in progress. In March 2006, further work at the same university revealed that there are some 700 regions of the human genome where genes have been reshaped by natural selection within the past 5,000 to 15,000 years. These genes include some of those responsible for our senses of taste and smell, digestion, bone structure, skin color, and brain function. One of the great emancipating results of genomics is to show that all racial and color differences are recent, superficial, and misleading. It is a moral certainty that between the time I finish writing this book and the time that it is published, several more fascinating and enlightening discoveries will be made in this burgeoning field. It may be too soon to say that all the progress is positive or upward, but human development is still underway. It shows in the manner in which we acquire immunities and also in the way in which we do not. Genome studies have identified early groups of northern Europeans who learned to domesticate cattle and acquired a distinct gene for lactose tolerance, while some people of more recent African descent, we all originate from Africa, are prone to a form of sickle cell anemia which, while upsetting in and of itself, results from an earlier mutation that gave protection against malaria. And all this will be further clarified if we are modest and patient enough to understand the building blocks of nature and the lowly stamp of our origins. No divine plan, let alone angelic intervention, is required. Everything works without that assumption. Thus, though I dislike to differ with such a great man, Voltaire was simply ludicrous when he said that if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. The human invention of God is the problem to begin with. Our evolution has been examined backward, with life temporarily outpacing extinction and knowledge now at last capable of reviewing and explaining ignorance. Religion, it is true, still possesses the huge, if cumbersome and unwieldy, advantage of having come first. But, as Sam Harris states rather pointedly in The End of Faith, if we lost all our hard-won knowledge and all our archives and all our ethics and morals in some Marquez-like fit of collective amnesia and had to reconstruct everything essential from scratch, it is difficult to imagine at what point we would need to remind or reassure ourselves that Jesus was born of a virgin. Thoughtful believers can take some consolation too. Skepticism and discovery have freed them from the burden of having to defend their God as a footling, clumsy, straws-in-the-hair mad scientist, and also from having to answer distressing questions about who inflicted the syphilis bacillus, or mandated the leper, or the idiot child, or devised the torments of Job. The faithful stand acquitted on that charge. We no longer have any need of a God to explain what is no longer mysterious. What believers will do, now that their faith is optional and private and irrelevant, is a matter for them. We should not care, as long as they make no further attempt to inculcate religion by any form of coercion. Chapter 7. Revelation, the nightmare of the Old Testament. Another way in which religion betrays itself and attempts to escape mere reliance on faith and instead offer evidence in the sense normally understood is by the argument from Revelation. On certain very special occasions, it is asserted, the divine will was made known by direct contact with randomly selected human beings who were supposedly vouchsafed unalterable laws that could then be passed on to those less favored. There are some very obvious objections to be made to this. In the first place, several such disclosures have been claimed to occur, at different times and places, to hugely discrepant prophets or mediums. In some cases, most notably the Christian, one revelation is apparently not sufficient and needs to be reinforced by successive apparitions, with the promise of a further but ultimate one to come. In other cases, the opposite difficulty occurs and the divine instruction is delivered only once, and for the final time, to an obscure personage whose lightest word then becomes law. Since all of these revelations, many of them hopelessly inconsistent, cannot by definition be simultaneously true, it must follow that some of them are false and illusory. It could also follow that only one of them is authentic. But in the first place this seems dubious, and in the second place it appears to necessitate religious war in order to decide whose revelation is the true one. A further difficulty is the apparent tendency of the Almighty to reveal himself only to unlettered and quasi-historical individuals in regions of Middle Eastern wasteland that were long the home of idol worship and superstition, and in many instances already littered with existing prophecies. The syncretic tendencies of monotheism and the common ancestry of the tales mean in effect that a rebuttal to one is a rebuttal to all. Horribly and hatefully, though they may have fought with one another, the three monotheisms claim to share a descent at least from the Pentateuch of Moses, and the Quran certifies Jews as people of the book, Jesus as a prophet, and a virgin as his mother. Interestingly, the Quran does not blame the Jews for the murder of Jesus, as one book of the Christian New Testament does, but this is only because it makes the bizarre claim that someone else was crucified by the Jews in his place. The foundation story of all three faiths concerns the purported meeting between Moses and God at the summit of Mount Sinai. This in turn led to the handing down of the Decalogue, or Ten Commandments. The tale is told in the second book of Moses, known as the Book of Exodus, in chapters 20 to 40. Most attention has been concentrated on chapter 20 itself, where the actual commandments are given. It should not perhaps be necessary to summarize and expose these, but the effort is actually worthwhile. In the first place, I'm using the King James or Authorized Version, one among many rival texts, laboriously translated by mortals either from Hebrew or Greek or Latin. The so-called commandments do not appear as a neat list of 10 orders and prohibitions. The first three are all variations of the same one, in which God insists on his own primacy and exclusivity, forbids the making of graven images, and prohibits the taking of his own name in vain. This prolonged throat-clearing is accompanied by some very serious admonitions, including a dire warning that the sins of the fathers will be visited on their children, even unto the third and fourth generation. This negates the moral and reasonable idea that children are innocent of their parents' offences. The fourth commandment insists on the observance of a holy Sabbath day and forbids all believers and their slaves and domestic servants to perform any work in the course of it. It is added that, as was said in the book of Genesis, God made all the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, leaving room for speculation as to what he did on the eighth day. The dictation then becomes more terse. Honour thy father and thy mother, this not for its own sake, but in order that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Only then come the four famous shalt nots, which flatly prohibit killing, adultery, theft, and false witness. Finally, there is a ban on covetousness, forbidding the desire for thy neighbour's house, manservant, maidservant, ox, ass, wife, and other chattel. It would be harder to find an easier proof that religion is man-made. There is, first, the monarchical growling about respect and fear, accompanied by a stern reminder of omnipotence and limitless revenge, of the sort with which a Babylonian or Assyrian emperor might have ordered the scribes to begin a proclamation. There is then a sharp reminder to keep working and only to relax when the absolutist says so. A few crisp legalistic reminders follow, one of which is commonly misrendered because the original Hebrew actually says, "Thou shalt do no murder." But however little one thinks of the Jewish tradition, it is surely insulting to the people of Moses to imagine that they had come this far under the impression that murder, adultery, theft, and perjury were permissible. The same unanswerable point can be made in a different way about the alleged later preachings of Jesus. When he tells the story of the Good Samaritan on that Jericho road, he is speaking of a man who acted in a humane and generous manner, without, obviously, ever having heard of Christianity, let alone having followed the pitiless teachings of the God of Moses, who never mentions human solidarity and compassion at all. No society ever discovered has failed to protect itself from self-evident crimes like those supposedly stipulated at Mount Sinai. Finally, instead of the condemnation of evil actions, there is an oddly phrased condemnation of impure thoughts. One can tell that this too is a man-made product of the alleged time and place because it throws in wife along with the other property, animal, human, and material of the neighbour. More important, it demands the impossible, a recurrent problem with all religious edicts. One may be forcibly restrained from wicked actions or barred from committing them, but to forbid people from contemplating them is too much. In particular, it is absurd to hope to banish envy of other people's possessions or fortunes, if only because the spirit of envy can lead to emulation and ambition and have positive consequences. It seems improbable that the American fundamentalists, who desire to see the Ten Commandments emblazoned in every schoolroom and courtroom, almost like a graven image, are so hostile to the spirit of capitalism. If God really wanted people to be free of such thoughts, he should have taken more care to invent a different species. Then there is the very salient question of what the commandments do not say. Is it too modern to notice that there is nothing about the protection of children from cruelty, nothing about rape, nothing about slavery, and nothing about genocide? Or is it too exactingly in context to notice that some of these very offences are about to be positively recommended? In verse 2 of the immediately following chapter, God tells Moses to instruct his followers about the conditions under which they may buy or sell slaves, or bore their ears through with an awl, and the rules governing the sale of their daughters. This is succeeded by the insanely detailed regulations governing oxes that gore and are gored, and including the notorious verses forfeiting life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Micromanagement of agricultural disputes breaks off for a moment with the abrupt verse 22:18, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." This was for centuries the warrant for the Christian torture and burning of women who did not conform. Occasionally, there are injunctions that are moral, and also, at least in the lovely King James Version, memorably phrased. "Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil" was taught to Bertrand Russell by his grandmother, and stayed with the old heretic all his life. However, one mutters a few sympathetic words for the forgotten and obliterated Hivites, Canaanites, and Hittites, also presumably part of the Lord's original creation, who are to be pitilessly driven out of their homes to make room for the ungrateful and mutinous children of Israel. This supposed covenant is the basis for a 19th-century irredentist claim to Palestine that has brought us endless trouble up to the present day. 74 of the elders, including Moses and Aaron, then meet God face to face. Several whole chapters are given over to the minutest stipulations about the lavish, immense ceremonies of sacrifice and propitiation that the Lord expects of his newly adopted people. But this all ends in... It goes without saying that none of the gruesome, disordered events described in Exodus ever took place. Israeli archaeologists are among the most professional in the world, even if their scholarship has sometimes been inflected with a wish to prove that the covenant between God and Moses was founded on some basis in fact. No group of diggers and scholars has ever worked harder, or with greater expectations, than the Israelis who sifted through the sands of Sinai and Canaan. The first of them was Yigal Yadin, whose best-known work was at Masada, and who had been charged by David Ben-Gurion to dig up the title deeds that would prove the Israeli claim to the Holy Land. Until a short time ago, his evidently politicized efforts were allowed a certain superficial plausibility. But then much more extensive and objective work was undertaken, presented most notably by Israel Finkelstein of the Institute of Archaeology at Tel Aviv University, and his colleague Neil Asher Silberman. These men regard the Hebrew Bible, or Pentateuch, as beautiful, and the story of modern Israel as an all-round inspiration, in which respects I humbly beg to differ. But their conclusion is final, and the more creditable for asserting evidence over self-interest. There was no flight from Egypt, no wandering in the desert, let alone for the incredible four-decade length of time mentioned in the Pentateuch, and no dramatic conquest of the Promised Land. It was all, quite simply and very ineptly, made up at a much later date. No Egyptian chronicle mentions this episode either, even in passing, and Egypt was the garrison power in Canaan, as well as the Nilotic region, at all the material times. Indeed, much of the evidence is the other way. Archaeology does confirm the presence of Jewish communities in Palestine from many thousands of years ago. This can be deduced, among other things, from the absence of those pig bones in the middens and dumps. And it does show that there was a kingdom of David, albeit rather a modest one. But all the Mosaic myths can be safely and easily discarded. I do not think that this is what the sour critics of faith sometimes call a reductionist conclusion. There is great pleasure to be had from the study of archaeology and of ancient texts, and great instruction too, and it brings us ever nearer to some approximation of the truth. On the other hand, it also raises the question of anti-theism once more. In The Future of an Illusion, Freud made the obvious point that religion suffered from one incurable deficiency. It was too clearly derived from our own desire to escape from, or survive, death. This critique of wish-thinking is strong and unanswerable, but it does not really deal with the horrors and cruelties and madnesses of the Old Testament. Who, except for an ancient priest, seeking to exert power by the tried and tested means of fear, could possibly wish that this hopelessly knotted skein of fable had any veracity? Well, the Christians had been at work on the same wishful attempt at proof long before the Zionist school of archaeology began to turn a spade. St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians had transmitted God's promise to the Jewish patriarchs, as an unbroken patrimony, to the Christians. And in the 19th and early 20th centuries, you could hardly throw away an orange peel in the Holy Land without hitting a fervent excavator. General Gordon, the biblical fanatic later slain by the Mahdi at Khartoum, was very much to the fore. William Albright of Baltimore was continually vindicating Joshua's Jericho and other myths. Some of these diggers, even given the primitive techniques of the period, counted as serious rather than merely opportunistic. Morally serious, too. The French-Dominican archaeologist Roland Deveau gave a hostage to fortune by saying that if the historical faith of Israel is not founded in history, such faith is erroneous, and therefore our faith is also. A most admirable and honest point, on which the good father may now be taken up. Long before modern inquiry and painstaking translation and excavation had helped enlighten us, it was well within the compass of a thinking person to see that the revelation at Sinai and the rest of the Pentateuch was an ill-carpentered fiction, bolted into place well after the non-events that it fails to describe convincingly or even plausibly. Intelligent schoolchildren have been upsetting their teachers with innocent but unanswerable questions ever since Bible study was instituted. The self-taught Thomas Paine has never been refuted since he wrote, while suffering dire persecution by French Jacobin anti-religionists, to show that these books are spurious, and that Moses is not the author of them, and still further, that they were not written in the time of Moses, nor till several hundred years afterwards, that they are an attempted history of the life of Moses, and of the times in which he is said to have lived, and also of the times prior thereto, written by some very ignorant and stupid pretenders, several hundred years after the death of Moses, as men now write histories of things that happened, or are supposed to have happened, several hundred or several thousand years ago. In the first place, the middle books of the Pentateuch, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, Genesis contains no mention of him, allude to Moses in the third person, as in "The Lord spake unto Moses." It could be argued that he preferred to speak of himself in the third person, though this habit is now well associated with megalomania, but this would make laughable such citations as Numbers 12:3, in which we read, "Now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were on the face of the earth." Apart from the absurdity of claiming to be meek in such a way as to assert superiority and meekness over all others, We have to remember the commandingly authoritarian and bloody manner in which Moses is described in almost every other chapter as having behaved. This gives us a choice between raving solipsism and the falsest of modesty. But perhaps Moses himself can be acquitted on these two charges, since he could hardly have managed the contortions of Deuteronomy. In this book, there is an introduction of the subject, then an introduction of Moses himself in mid-speech, then a resumption of narrative by whoever is writing, then another speech by Moses, and then an account of the death, burial, and magnificence of Moses himself. It is to be presumed that the account of the funeral was not written by the man whose funeral it was, though this problem does not seem to have occurred to whoever fabricated the text. That whoever wrote the account was writing many years later seems to be very clear. We are told that Moses reached the age of 110 with his eye not dim, nor his natural force abated, and then ascended to the summit of Mount Nebo, from which he could obtain a clear view of the promised land that he would never actually enter. The prophet, his natural force all of a sudden abated, then dies in the land of Moab and is interred there. No one knows, says the author, unto this day, where the sepulchre of Moses lies. It is added that there has since been no comparable prophet in Israel. These two expressions have no effect if they do not denote the passage of a considerable time. We are then expected to believe that an unspecified he buried Moses. If this was Moses himself in the third person again, it seems distinctly implausible, and if it was God himself who performed the obsequy, then there is no way for the writer of Deuteronomy to have known it. Indeed, the author seems very unclear about all the details of this event, as would be expected if he was reconstructing something half forgotten. The same is self-evidently true of innumerable other anachronisms, where Moses speaks of events, the consumption of manna in Canaan, the capture of the huge bedstead of the giant Og, king of Bashan, which may never have occurred at all, but which are not even claimed to have occurred until well after his death. The strong likelihood that this interpretation is the correct one is reinforced in Deuteronomy's fourth and fifth chapters, where Moses assembles his followers and gives them the Lord's commandments all over again. This is not such a surprise. The Pentateuch contains two discrepant accounts of the creation, two different genealogies of the seed of Adam, and two narratives of the flood. One of these chapters has Moses talking about himself at great length, and the other has him in reported speech. In the fourth chapter, the commandment against making graven images is extended to prohibiting any similitude or likeness of any figure, whether human or animal, for any purpose. In the fifth chapter, the contents of the two stone tablets are repeated roughly in the same form as in Exodus, but with a significant difference. This time the writer forgets that the Sabbath day is holy because God made heaven and earth in 6 days and then rested on the seventh. Suddenly the Sabbath is holy because God brought his people out of the land of Egypt. Then we must come to those things which probably did not happen and which we must be glad did not. In Deuteronomy, Moses gives orders for parents to have their children stoned to death for indiscipline, which seems to violate at least one of the commandments, and continually makes demented pronouncements. He that is wounded in the stones, or hath his privy member cut off, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. In Numbers, he addresses his generals after a battle, and rages at them for sparing so many civilians. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known a man by lying with him. But all the women children that hath not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. This is certainly not the worst of the genocidal incitements that occur in the Old Testament. Israeli rabbis solemnly debate to this very day whether the demand to exterminate the Amalekites is a coded commandment to do away with the Palestinians. But it has an element of lasciviousness that makes it slightly too obvious what the rewards of a freebooting soldier could be. At least so I think, and so thought Thomas Paine, who wrote not to disprove religion but rather to vindicate deism against what he considered to be foul accretions in the holy books. He said that this was an order to butcher the boys, to massacre the mothers, and debauch the daughters, which drew him a hurt reply from one of the celebrated divines of the day, the Bishop of Llandaff. The stout Welsh bishop indignantly claimed that it was not at all clear from the context that the young females were being preserved for immoral purposes rather than for unpaid labour. Against dumb innocence like this, it might be heartless to object, even if it were not for the venerable clergyman's sublime indifference to the fate of the boy children, and indeed their mothers. One could go through the Old Testament book by book, here pausing to notice a lapidary phrase, "Man is born to trouble," as the book of Job says, "as the sparks fly upward," and there a fine verse, but always encountering the same difficulties. People attain impossible ages and yet conceive children. Mediocre individuals engage in single combat or one-on-one argument with God or his emissaries, raising afresh the whole question of divine omnipotence or even divine common sense, and the ground is forever soaked with the blood of the innocent. Moreover, the context is oppressively confined and local. None of these provincials, or their deity, seems to have any idea of a world beyond the desert, the flocks and herds, and the imperatives of nomadic subsistence. This is forgivable on the part of the provincial yokels, obviously, but then what of their supreme guide and wrathful tyrant? Perhaps he was made in their image, even if not graven. Chapter 8. The New Testament exceeds the evil of the Old One. The work of rereading the Old Testament is sometimes tiring but always necessary because as one proceeds there begin to occur some sinister premonitions. Abraham, another ancestor of all monotheism, is ready to make a human sacrifice of his own firstborn, and a rumor comes that a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. Gradually these two myths begin to converge. It's needful to bear this in mind when coming to the New Testament, because if you pick up any of the four Gospels and read them at random, it will not be long before you learn that such and such an action or saying attributed to Jesus was done so that an ancient prophecy should come true. Speaking of the arrival of Jesus in Jerusalem, riding astride a donkey, Matthew says in his chapter 21, verse 4, "All of this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet." The reference is probably to Zechariah, chapter 9, verse 9, where it is said that when the Messiah comes, he will be riding on an ass. The Jews are still awaiting this arrival, and the Christians claim it has already taken place. If it should seem odd that an action should be deliberately performed in order that a foretelling be vindicated, that is because it is odd. And it is necessarily odd, because, just like the Old Testament, the New One is also a work of crude carpentry, hammered together long after its purported events, and full of improvised attempts to make things come out right. For concision, I shall again defer to a finer writer than myself and quote what H. L. Mencken irrefutably says in his Treatise on the Gods. The simple fact is that the New Testament, as we know it, is a helter-skelter accumulation of more or less discordant documents, some of them probably of respectable origin, but others palpably apocryphal, and that most of them, the good along with the bad, show unmistakable signs of having been tampered with. Both Payne and Mencken, who put themselves, for different reasons, to an honest effort to read the texts, have been borne out by later biblical scholarship, much of it first embarked upon to show that the texts were still relevant. But this argument takes place over the heads of those to whom the good book is all that is required. One recalls the governor of Texas, who asked if the Bible should also be taught in Spanish, replied that, "If English was good enough for Jesus, then it's good enough for me." Rightly are the simple so-called. In 2004, a soap opera film about the death of Jesus was produced by an Australian fascist and ham actor named Mel Gibson. Mr. Gibson adheres to a crackpot and schismatic Catholic sect, consisting mainly of himself and of his even more thuggish father, and has stated that it is a pity that his own dear wife is going to hell because she does not accept the correct sacraments. This foul doom he calmly describes as a statement from the chair. The doctrine of his own sect is explicitly anti-Semitic, and the movie sought tirelessly to lay the blame for the crucifixion upon the Jews. In spite of this obvious bigotry, which did lead to criticism from some more cautious Christians, the Passion of the Christ was opportunistically employed by many mainstream churches as a box office recruiting tool. At one of the ecumenical pre-publicity events which he sponsored, Mr. Gibson defended his filmic Farrago, which is also an exercise in sadomasochistic homoeroticism, starring a talentless lead actor who was apparently born in Iceland or Minnesota, as being based on the reports of eyewitnesses. At the time, I thought it extraordinary that a multi-million-dollar hit could be openly based on such a patently fraudulent claim, but nobody seemed to turn a hair. Even Jewish authorities were largely silent. But then some of them wanted to dampen down this old argument, which for centuries had led to Easter pogroms against the Christ-killing Jews. It was not until 2 decades after the Second World War, that the Vatican formally withdrew the charge of deicide against the Jewish people as a whole. And the truth is that the Jews used to claim credit for the crucifixion. Maimonides described the punishment of the detestable Nazarene heretic as one of the greatest achievements of the Jewish elders, insisted that the name Jesus never be mentioned except when accompanied by a curse, and announced that his punishment was to be boiled in excrement for all eternity. What a good Catholic Maimonides would have made. However, he fell into the same error as do the Christians in assuming that the four Gospels were in any sense a historical record. Their multiple authors, none of whom published anything until many decades after the crucifixion, cannot agree on anything of importance. Matthew and Luke cannot concur on the virgin birth or the genealogy of Jesus. They flatly contradict each other on the flight into Egypt, Matthew saying that Joseph was warned in a dream to make an immediate escape, and Luke saying that all three stayed in Bethlehem until Mary's purification according to the laws of Moses, which would make it 40 days, and then went back to Nazareth via Jerusalem. Incidentally, if the dash to Egypt to conceal a child from Herod's infanticide campaign has any truth to it, then Hollywood and many, many Christian iconographers have been deceiving us. It would have been very difficult to take a blonde, blue-eyed baby to the Nile Delta without attracting rather than avoiding attention. The Gospel according to Luke states that the miraculous birth occurred in a year when the Emperor Caesar Augustus ordered a census for the purpose of taxation, and that this happened at a time when Herod reigned in Judea and Quirinius was governor of Syria. This is the closest to a triangulation of historical dating that any biblical writer even attempts. But Herod died 4 years BC, and during his rulership, the governor of Syria was not Quirinius. There is no mention of any Augustan census by any Roman historian, but the Jewish chronicler Josephus mentions one that did occur, without the onerous requirement for people to return to their places of birth, and 6 years after the birth of Jesus is supposed to have taken place. This is, all of it, quite evidently, a garbled and oral-based reconstruction, undertaken some considerable time after the fact. The scribes cannot even agree on the mythical elements. They disagree wildly about the Sermon on the Mount, the anointing of Jesus, the treachery of Judas, and Peter's haunting denial. Most astonishingly, they cannot converge on a common account of the crucifixion or the resurrection. Thus, the one interpretation that we simply have to discard is the one that claims divine warrant for all four of them. The book on which all four may possibly have been based, known speculatively to scholars as Q, has been lost forever, which seems distinctly careless on the part of the God who has claimed to have inspired it. 60 years ago, at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, a trove of neglected Gospels was discovered near a very ancient Coptic Christian site. These scrolls were of the same period and provenance as many of the subsequently canonical and authorized Gospels, and have long gone under the collective name of Gnostic. This was the title given them by a certain Irenaeus, an early church father who placed them under a ban as heretical. They include the Gospels, or narratives, of marginal but significant figures in the accepted New Testament, such as Doubting Thomas and Mary Magdalene. They now also include the Gospel of Judas, known for centuries to have existed, but now brought to light and published by the National Geographic Society in the spring of 2006. The book is chiefly spiritualist drivel, as one might expect, but it offers a version of events that is fractionally more credible than the official account. For one thing, it maintains, as do its partner texts, that the supposed God of the Old Testament is the one to be avoided, a ghastly emanation from sick minds. This makes it easy to see why it was so firmly banned and denounced. Orthodox Christianity is nothing if it is not a vindication and completion of that evil story. Judas attends the final Passover meal, as usual, but departs from the customary script. When Jesus appears to pity his other disciples for knowing so little about what is at stake, his rogue follower boldly says that he believes he knows what the difficulty is. "I know who you are and where you have come from," he tells the leader. "You are from the immortal realm of Barbelo." This Barbelo is not a god, but a heavenly destination, a motherland beyond the stars. Jesus comes from this celestial realm, but is not the son of any Mosaic god. Instead, he is an avatar of Seth, the third and little-known son of Adam. He is the one who will show the Sethians the way home. Recognizing that Judas is at least a minor adept of this cult, Jesus takes him to one side and awards him the special mission of helping him shed his fleshly form and thus return heavenward. He also promises to show him the stars that will enable Judas to follow on. Deranged science fiction though this is, it makes infinitely more sense than the everlasting curse placed on Judas for doing what somebody had to do in this otherwise pedantically arranged chronicle of a death foretold. It also makes infinitely more sense than blaming the Jews for all eternity. For a long time there was incandescent debate over which of the Gospels should be regarded as divinely inspired. Some argued for these and some for others, and many a life was horribly lost on the proposition. Nobody dared say that they were all man-inscribed long after the supposed drama was over, and the revelation of St. John seems to have squeezed into the canon because of its author's rather ordinary name. But as Jorge Luis Borges put it, had the Alexandrian Gnostics won the day, some later Dante would have drawn us a hypnotically beautiful word picture of the wonders of Barbelo. This concept I might choose to call the Borges shale, the verve and imagination needed to visualize a cross-section of evolutionary branches and bushes, with the extraordinary but real possibility that a different stem or line or tune or poem had predominated in the labyrinth. Great ceilings and steeples and hymns, he might have added, would have consecrated it, and skilled torturers would have worked for days on those who doubted the truth of Barbelo, beginning with the fingernails and working their way ingeniously toward the testicles, the vagina, the eyes and the viscera. Non-belief in Barbelo would, correspondingly, have been an unfailing sign that one had no morals at all. The best argument I know for the highly questionable existence of Jesus is this. His illiterate living disciples left us no record and in any event could not have been Christians, since they were never to read those later books in which Christians must affirm belief, and in any case had no idea that anyone would ever found a church on their master's announcements. There is scarcely a word in any of the later assembled Gospels to suggest that Jesus wanted to be the founder of a church either. Notwithstanding all that, the jumbled Old Testament prophecies indicate that the Messiah will be born in the city of David, which seems indeed to have been Bethlehem. However, Jesus' parents were apparently from Nazareth, and if they had a child, he was most probably delivered in that town. Thus, a huge amount of fabrication concerning Augustus, Herod, and Quirinius is involved in confecting the census tale and moving the nativity scene to Bethlehem, where, by the way, no stable is ever mentioned. But why do this at all, since a much easier fabrication would have had him born in Bethlehem in the first place, without any needless to do? The very attempts to bend and stretch the story may be inverse proof that someone of later significance was indeed born, so that in retrospect, and to fulfil the prophecies, the evidence had to be massaged to some extent. But then even my attempt to be fair and open-minded in this case is subverted by the Gospel of John, which seems to suggest that Jesus was neither born in Bethlehem nor descended from King David. If the apostles do not know or cannot agree, of what use is my analysis? In any case, if his royal lineage is something to brag and prophesy about, why the insistence elsewhere on apparently lowly birth? Almost all religions, from Buddhism to Islam, feature either a humble prophet or a prince who comes to identify with the poor. But what is this if not populism? It is hardly a surprise if religions choose to address themselves first to the majority who are poor and bewildered and uneducated. The contortions and illiteracies of the New Testament have filled up many books by eminent scholars and have never been explained by any Christian authority except in the feeblest terms of metaphor and a Christ of faith. This feebleness derives from the fact that until recently, Christians could simply burn or silence anybody who asked any inconvenient questions. The Gospels are useful, however, in re-demonstrating the same point as their predecessor volumes, which is that religion is man-made. The law was given by Moses, says St. John, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. St. Matthew tries for the same effect, basing everything on a verse or two from the prophet Isaiah, which told King Ahaz almost 8 centuries before the still unfixed date of the birth of Jesus that the Lord shall give you a sign. A virgin will conceive and bear a son. This encouraged Ahaz to believe that he would be given victory over his enemies, which in the result, even if you take his story as historical narrative, he was not. The picture is even further altered when we know that the word translated as virgin, namely Alma, means only a young woman. In any case, parthenogenesis is not possible for human mammals, and even if this law were to be relaxed in just one case, it would not prove that the resulting infant had any divine power. Thus, and as usual, religion arouses suspicion by trying to prove too much. By reverse analogy, the Sermon on the Mount replicates Moses on Mount Sinai, and the nondescript disciples stand in for the Jews who followed Moses wherever he went. And thus, prophecy is fulfilled for anyone who doesn't notice or doesn't care that the story is being reverse-engineered, as we might now say. In a short passage of only one gospel, seized upon by the Jew-baiting Mel Gibson, the rabbis are made to echo God on Sinai, and actually to call for the guilt in the blood of Jesus to descend upon all their subsequent generations. A demand that, even if it were to be made, lay well beyond their right or their power. But the case of the virgin birth is the easiest possible proof that humans were involved in the manufacture of a legend. Jesus makes large claims for his heavenly father, but never mentions that his mother is or was a virgin, and is repeatedly very rude and coarse to her when she makes an appearance, as Jewish mothers will, to ask or to see how he's getting on. She herself appears to have no memory of the Archangel Gabriel's visitation, or of the swarm of angels, both telling her that she's the mother of God. In all accounts, everything that her son does comes to her as a complete surprise, if not a shock. What can he be doing talking to rabbis in the temple? What's he saying when he curtly reminds her that he's on his father's business? One might have expected a stronger maternal memory, especially from someone who had undergone the experience, alone among all women, of discovering herself pregnant without having undergone the notorious preconditions for that happy state. Luke even makes a telling slip at one point, speaking of the parents of Jesus when he refers only to Joseph and Mary as they visit the temple for her purification and are hailed by the old man Simeon, who pronounces his wonderful Nunc Dimittis, which, another of my old chapel favourites, may also be an intended echo of Moses, glimpsing the promised land only in extreme old age. Then there's the extraordinary matter of Mary's large brood. Matthew informs us, chapter 13, verses 55 to 57, that there were four brothers of Jesus and some sisters also. In the Gospel of James, which is not canonical but not disowned either, we have the account by Jesus' brother of that same name, who was evidently very active in religious circles at the same period. Arguably, Mary could have conceived as a Virgo intacta and delivered a baby, which would certainly have made her to that extent less intact. But how did she go on producing children by the man Joseph, who only exists in reported speech, and thus make the Holy Family so large that eyewitnesses kept remarking on it? In order to resolve this near unmentionable and near sexual dilemma, reverse engineering is again applied, this time much more recently than the frantic early church councils that decided which Gospels were synoptic and which were apocryphal. It is determined that Mary herself, of whose birth there is absolutely no account in any holy book, must have had a prior immaculate conception that rendered her essentially stainless. And it is further determined that since the wage of sin is death, and she cannot possibly have sinned, she cannot have died. Hence the dogma of the Assumption, which asserts out of thin air that thin air is the medium through which she went to heaven while avoiding the grave. It is of interest to note the dates of these magnificent, ingenious edicts. The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception was announced or discovered by Rome in 1852, and the dogma of the Assumption in 1951. To say that something is man-made is not always to say that it is stupid. These heroic rescue attempts deserve some credit, even as we watch the leaky original vessel sink without trace, but inspired, though the Church's resolution may be, it would insult the deity to claim that such inspiration was in any way divine. Just as the script of the Old Testament is riddled with dreams and with astrology, the sun standing still so that Joshua can complete his massacre at a site that has never been located, so the Christian Bible is full of star predictions, notably the one over Bethlehem, and witch doctors and sorcerers. Many of the sayings and deeds of Jesus are innocuous, most especially the Beatitudes, which express such fanciful wish-thinking about the meek and the peacemakers. But many are unintelligible and show a belief in magic. Several are absurd and show a primitive attitude to agriculture. This extends to all mentions of ploughing and sowing, and all allusions to mustard or fig trees. And many are on the face of it flat-out immoral. The analogy of humans to lilies, for instance, suggests, along with many other injunctions, that things like thrift, innovation, family life, and so forth, are a sheer waste of time. Take no thought for the morrow. This is why some of the Gospels, synoptic and apocryphal, report people, including his family members, saying at the time that they thought Jesus must be mad. There were also those who noticed that he was often a rather rigid Jewish sectarian. In Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 to 28, we read of his contempt for a Canaanite woman, who implored his aid for an exorcism and was brusquely told that he would not waste his energy on a non-Jew. His disciples and the persistence of the woman eventually persuaded him to unbend and to cast out the non-devil. In my opinion, an idiosyncratic story like this is another oblique reason for thinking that some such personality may at some time have lived. There were many deranged prophets roaming Palestine at the time, but this one reportedly believed himself at least some of the time to be God or the Son of God, and that has made all the difference. Make just two assumptions, that he believed this, and that he also promised his followers that he would reveal his kingdom before they came to the end of their own lives, and all but one or two of his gnomic remarks make some kind of sense. This point was never put more frankly than by C.S. Lewis, who has recently re-emerged as the most popular Christian apologist, in his Mere Christianity. He happens to be speaking about the claim of Jesus to take sins on himself. Now, unless the speaker is God, this is really so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offences against himself. You tread on my toes and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what should we make of a man, himself unrobbed and untrodden on, who announced that he forgave you for treading on other men's toes and stealing other men's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. Yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven, and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offences. This makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken, and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker, who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in history. It will be noticed that Lewis assumes, on no firm evidence whatever, that Jesus actually was a character in history, but let that pass. He deserves some credit for accepting the logic and the morality of what he has just stated. To those who argue that Jesus may have been a great moral teacher without being divine, of whom the deist Thomas Jefferson incidentally claimed to be one, Lewis has this stinging riposte. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman and something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. I am not choosing a straw man here. Lewis is the main chosen propaganda vehicle for Christianity in our time, and nor am I accepting his rather wild supernatural categories, such as devil and demon. Least of all do I accept his reasoning, which is so pathetic as to defy description and which takes his two false alternatives as exclusive antitheses, and then uses them to fashion a crude non sequitur. Now, it seems to me obvious that he was neither a lunatic nor a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. However, I do credit him with honesty and with some courage. Either the Gospels are in some sense literal truth, or the whole thing is essentially a fraud and perhaps an immoral one at that. Well, it can be stated with certainty, and on their own evidence, that the Gospels are most certainly not literal truth. This means that many of the sayings and teachings of Jesus are hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay, which it helps explain their garbled and contradictory nature. The most glaring of these, at least in retrospect, and certainly from the believer's point of view, concern the imminence of his second coming and his complete indifference to the founding of any temporal church. The logia, or reported speeches, are repeatedly cited by bishops of the early church who wished that they had been present at the time but were not, as eagerly solicited third-hand commentaries. Let me give a conspicuous example. Many years after C.S. Lewis had gone to his reward, a very serious young man named Barton Ehrman began to examine his own fundamentalist assumptions. He had attended the two most eminent Christian fundamentalist academies in the United States and was considered by the faithful to be among their champions. Fluent in Greek and Hebrew, he's now holder of a chair in religious studies, he eventually could not quite reconcile his faith with his scholarship. He was astonished to find that some of the best-known Jesus stories were scribbled into the canon long after the fact, and that this was true of perhaps the best known of them all. This story is the celebrated one about the woman taken in adultery, John chapter 8, verses 3 to 11. Who has not heard or read of how the Jewish Pharisees, skilled in casuistry, dragged this poor woman before Jesus and demanded to know if he agreed with the Mosaic punishment of stoning her to death? If he did not, he violated the law. If he did, he made nonsense of his own preachings. One easily pictures the squalid zeal with which they pounced upon the woman, and the calm reply, after writing upon the ground, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her," has entered our literature and our consciousness. This episode is even celebrated on celluloid. It makes a flashback appearance in Mel Gibson's Travesty, and it is a lovely moment in David Lean's Dr. Zhivago, where Lara goes to the priest in her extremity and is asked what Jesus said to the fallen woman. "Go and sin no more," is her reply. "And did she, child?" asks the priest fiercely. "I don't know, Father." "Nobody knows," responds the priest, unhelpfully in the circumstances. "Nobody indeed does know. Long before I read Ehrman, I had some questions of my own. If the New Testament is supposed to vindicate Moses, why are the gruesome laws of the Pentateuch to be undermined? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and the killing of witches may seem brutish and stupid, but if only non-sinners have the right to punish, then how could an imperfect society ever determine how to prosecute offenders? We should all be hypocrites. And what authority did Jesus have to forgive? Presumably, at least one wife or husband somewhere in the city felt cheated and outraged. Is Christianity then sheer sexual permissiveness? If so, it has been gravely misunderstood ever since. And what was being written on the ground? Nobody knows again. Furthermore, the story says that after the Pharisees and the crowd had melted away, presumably from embarrassment, nobody was left except Jesus and the woman. In that case, who is the narrator of what he said to her? For all that, I thought it a fine enough story. Professor Ehrman goes further. He asks some more obvious questions. If the woman was taken in adultery, which means in flagrante delicto, then where's her male partner? Mosaic law, adumbrated in Leviticus, makes it clear that both must undergo the stoning. I suddenly realize that the core of the story's charm is that of the shivering, lonely girl, hissed at and dragged away by a crowd of sex-starved fanatics, and finally encountering a friendly face. As to the writing in the dust, Ehrman mentions an old tradition which postulates that Jesus was scrawling the known transgressions of others present, thus leading to blushing and shuffling and eventually to hasty departure. I find I love this idea, even if it would mean a level of worldly curiosity and prurience and foresight on his part that raises its own difficulties. Overarching all this, though, is the shocking fact that, as Ehrman concedes, the story is not found in our oldest and best manuscripts of the Gospel of John. Its writing style is very different from what we find in the rest of John, including the stories immediately before and after. And it includes a large number of words and phrases that are otherwise alien to the Gospel. The conclusion is unavoidable. This passage was not originally part of the Gospel. I have again selected my source on the basis of evidence against interest, in other words, from someone whose original scholarly and intellectual journey was not at all intended to challenge Holy Writ. The case for biblical consistency or authenticity or inspiration has been in tatters for some time, and the rents and tears only become more obvious with better research, and thus no revelation can be derived from that quarter. So then, let the advocates and partisans of religion rely on faith alone, and let them be brave enough to admit that this is what they are doing. Chapter 9. The Quran is borrowed from both Jewish and Christian myths. The doings and sayings of Moses and Abraham and Jesus, being so ill-founded and so inconsistent, as well as so often immoral, one must proceed in the same spirit of inquiry to what many believe is the last revelation, that of the Prophet Muhammad and his Quran or recitation. Here again, the angel or archangel, Gabriel, is found at work, dictating surahs or verses to a person of little or no learning. Here again are stories of a Noah-like flood, and injunctions against idol worship. Here again the Jews are the first recipients of the message, and the first both to hear it and to discard it. And here again there is a vast commentary of doubtful anecdote about the actual doings and sayings of the Prophet, this time known as the Hadith. Islam is at once the most and the least interesting of the world's monotheisms. It builds upon its primitive Jewish and Christian predecessors, selecting a chunk here and a shard there, and thus if these fall, it partly falls also. Its founding narrative likewise takes place within an astonishingly small compass and relates facts about extremely tedious local quarrels. None of the original documents, such as they are, can be contrasted with any Hebrew or Greek or Latin texts. Almost all of the tradition is oral, and all of it is in Arabic. Indeed, many authorities agree that the Quran is only intelligible in that tongue, which is itself subject to innumerable idiomatic and regional inflections. This would leave us on the face of it with the absurd and potentially dangerous conclusion that God was a monoglot. Before me is a book, Introducing Muhammad, written by two extremely unctuous British Muslims who are hoping to present a friendly version of Islam to the West. Ingratiating and selective as their text may be, they insist that, as the literal word of God, the Quran is the Quran, only in the original revealed text. A translation can never be the Quran. That inimitable symphony, the very sound of which moves men and women to tears. A translation can only be an attempt to give the barest suggestion of the meaning of words contained in the Quran. This is why all Muslims, whatever their mother tongue, always recite the Quran in its original Arabic. The authors go on to make some highly disobliging observations about the Penguin translation by N.J. Dawood, which makes me glad that I've always employed the Pictol version, but no likely to be convinced that if I wish to become a convert, I must master another language. In my own country of birth, I'm sadly aware that there is a beautiful, poetic tradition unavailable to me because I will never know the marvellous tongue called Gaelic. Even if God is or was an Arab, an unsafe assumption, how could he expect to reveal himself by way of an illiterate person who in turn could not possibly hope to pass on the unaltered, let alone unalterable, words? The point may seem minor, but it is not. To Muslims, the enunciation of the divine to a person of extreme unlettered simplicity has something of the same value as the humble vessel of the Virgin Mary has to Christians. It also possesses the same useful merit of being entirely unverifiable and unfalsifiable. Since Mary must be presumed to have spoken Aramaic and Muhammad Arabic, it can, I suppose, be granted that God is in fact multilingual and can speak any language he chooses. He opted in both cases to use the Archangel Gabriel as the intermediate deliverer of his message. However, the impressive fact remains that all religions have staunchly resisted any attempt to translate their sacred texts into languages understanded of the people, as the Cranmer Prayer Book phrases it. There would have been no Protestant Reformation if it were not for the long struggle to have the Bible rendered into the Vulgate and the priestly monopoly therefore broken. Devout men like Wycliffe, Coverdale, and Tyndale were burned alive for even attempting early translations. The Catholic Church has never recovered from its abandonment of the mystifying Latin ritual, and the Protestant mainstream has suffered hugely from rendering its own Bibles into more everyday speech. Some mystical Jewish sects still insist on Hebrew and play Kabbalistic word games, even with the spaces between letters, but among most Jews too, the supposedly unchangeable rituals of antiquity have been abandoned. The spell of the clerical class has been broken. Only in Islam has there been no reformation, and to this day, any vernacular version of the Quran must still be printed with an Arabic parallel text. This ought to arouse suspicion, even in the slowest mind. Later Muslim conquests, impressive in their speed and scope and decisiveness, have lent point to the idea that these Arabic incantations must have had something to them. But if you allow this cheap earthly victory as a proof, you allow the same to Joshua's blood-soaked tribesmen or to the Christian crusaders and conquistadors. There is a further objection. All religions take care to silence or to execute those who question them, and I choose to regard this recurrent tendency as a sign of their weakness rather than their strength. It has, however, been some time since Judaism and Christianity resorted openly to torture and censorship. Not only did Islam begin by condemning all doubters to eternal fire, but it still claims the right to do so in almost all of its dominions, and still preaches that these dominions can and must be extended by war. There has never been an attempt in any age to challenge or even investigate the claims of Islam that has not been met with extremely harsh and swift repression. Provisionally, then, one is entitled to conclude that the apparent unity and confidence of the faith is a mask for a very deep and probably justifiable insecurity. That there are, and always have been, sanguinary feuds between different schools of Islam, resulting in strictly inter-Muslim accusations of heresy and profanity, and in terrible acts of violence, naturally goes without saying. I have tried my best with this religion, which is as foreign to me as it is to the many millions who will always doubt that God entrusted a non-reader, through an intermediary, with the demanding call to read. As I said, I long ago acquired a copy of the Marmaduke Pictol translation of the Quran, which has been certified by senior sources in the Ulema, or Islamic Religious Authority, to be the nearest to an approximate rendition into English. I have been to innumerable gatherings, from Friday prayers in Tehran to mosques in Damascus and Jerusalem and Doha and Istanbul and Washington, D.C., and I can attest that the recitation in Arabic does indeed have the apparent power to create bliss and also rage among those who hear it. I have also attended prayers in Malaysia and Indonesia and Bosnia, where there is resentment among non-Arabic-speaking Muslims at the privilege granted to Arabs and to Arabic, and to Arab movements and regimes, in a religion that purports to be universal. I have in my own home received Sayyid Hossein Khomeini, grandson of the Ayatollah, and a cleric from the holy city of Qum, and carefully handed him my own copy of the Quran. He kissed it, discussed it at length and with reverence, and for my instruction wrote in the back flap the verses which he thought had disproved his grandfather's claim to clerical authority in this world, as well as overthrew